Tanta Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Violence, A Very Short Introduction, by Philip Dwyer, narrated by Gary Paul Williams.
Publisher's note, this audiobook will refer to visual elements included in the print and ebook editions of the book.
Chapter 1. Violence Past and Present. Thinking about violence. Violence is a word that encompasses many different acts of aggression. The parent who beats his or her child, the partner who beats or kills their spouse, the mobster who eliminates a rival, the gang of young men who rape a woman, the military or the police who torture a suspect, the child soldier who is ordered to kill, the suicide terrorist who kills himself and others, the rioter who sets fire to a car, the villager who hacks his neighbour to death with a machete. The list of what constitutes violence is endless and is so pervasive across so many societies and cultures that it forces us to ask, is it part of human nature? All societies are violent, and all individuals have the capacity for violence. But not all societies and individuals are equally violent. But if violence is a constant throughout history, what does that say about us as a species? Does violence come naturally to people, or do people have to overcome their reluctance to engage in violent acts? Might modern humans find it more difficult to overcome that reluctance than people in past centuries, depending on the culture in question? Or is violence a social tool or function that is culturally dependent? This short introduction examines violence in history in the modern world from the mid-18th century onwards, although there will be forays into earlier periods in history when understandings of particular kinds of violence require it. I will also explore how violence in the modern world differs from the pre-modern world, and what is significant about those differences. That means understanding what violence is and how its manifestations might vary from one region of the world to another. To understand those differences, past and present, I adopt the argument that violence is culturally relative, so that in one part of the world, an act can be considered an intolerable transgression by most members of that society, while in another part of the world, and at the same time, that same act may be considered entirely legitimate. That is, violence is what a society acknowledges as violent. It is the difference between what is tolerated and what is not tolerated, between what is acceptable and not acceptable. The central question, as the historian Franziska Letts has aptly put it, is not therefore what is violence, but what makes violence what it is in any given society. That doesn't mean that violence is simply in the eye of the beholder, but it is an acknowledgement that it is best understood in particular, very specific, cultural, social, economic, and political contexts. A question of definitions. No matter what specific act of violence one might be thinking about, it is almost certainly being carried out as these lines are being read. To understand violence, its meanings, its mechanisms, its functions, its uses, it is important to understand the world in which we live. Violence sheds light on the individual or groups who use it, but more broadly on the societies in which those individuals live, including the state and its institutions. Violence is nevertheless an ambiguous concept. Its definitional boundaries shift and change over time, depending on the cultural and political conventions of any given society. This is an important point. Violence is often what a society perceives to be a violent act. Moreover, each subcategory of violence, rape, homicide, infanticide, massacre, genocide, and so on, has its own questions of definition and debates around what constitutes that particular kind of violence. It is not unusual to find discussions on violence opening with a question, what actually is violence? The answer is, it depends. That response might seem glib, so let me explain what I mean by looking at two definitions of violence, one quite narrow, the other broader in scope. The first is by the Dutch criminologist Peter Spierenburg, taking his cue from the anthropologist David Riches, who defined violence as an intentional encroachment upon the physical integrity of the body. This idea of violence is limited to the physical infliction of harm on others and precludes things like the perpetration of psychological violence or the psychological trauma experienced in the aftermath of violence. A more comprehensive definition comes from the World Health Organization, which broadly defines violence as the intentional use of physical force or power threatened or actual against oneself, another person, or against a group or community that either results in or has a high likelihood of resulting in injury, death, psychological harm, maldevelopment, or deprivation. This definition considers violence to be more than just the physical transgression of the body. It is also about the harmful emotional and psychological after-effects that it produces. In both definitions, the intentional part is important. It precludes accidents, such as car accidents or accidental shootings, but includes most acts of violence encompassed by war, murder, rape, torture, corporal punishment, brawls, suicide, as well as state-sponsored violence. Neither of these definitions, however, includes the destruction of inanimate objects, such as property or sites of cultural heritage, that are often targeted during genocide, or indeed considers the untold harm done to animals and the environment by humans over the centuries. Other scholars have been at pains to expand the definition of violence to include actions that were once never considered violent, but now are, including systems that maintain people in coercive, exploitative relationships, such as slavery and forced labor, human trafficking in people and body parts, the slow and utterly unspectacular grind of poverty that can lead to disease and premature death, and the over-exploitation and degradation of the environment. The broader categories, such as racism, incarceration, along with physical and mental violence that can entail death from preventable accidents or disease, abuse and cruelty towards animals, the industrialized killing of animals for consumption, as well as bullying, humiliation and verbal abuse, especially if it results in self-harm or suicide, are also now regarded as forms of violence by some scholars. These broader categories of violence question the notion of intent, that is, scholars who adopt a broad definition of violence often argue that it cannot be reduced to a corporal experience and that the outcomes produced by violent action are often unintentional. A violent action is generally calculated, but its consequences are often unforeseen. We can see just how difficult it can be to try and precisely define what is violence. Some of the broader categories of violence that have been mentioned will not be taken into consideration in this short introduction. As a result, I will have to bypass some of the leading thinkers of those forms of violence, such as the Norwegian sociologist Johan Galtung, who first formulated the idea of structural violence, the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, who developed the idea of symbolic violence, and the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek, who makes a distinction between what he calls subjective, highly visible, and objective, invisible violence. All three question the notion of intent, arguing that violence cannot be reduced to a corporal experience, and that the outcomes produced by a violent action are often unforeseen and unintentional. For the purposes of this short introduction, I have adopted what some may deem a narrow definition of violence.
I'm going to limit my discussion to acts born of a conscious desire to intentionally harm another person, group, or community, resulting in either physical injury or death. I have, therefore, focused on the more visible physical acts of violence, interpersonal, gendered, communal, religious, sexual, criminal, and political, at the expense of other forms of non-physical violence, which will only be touched on in the last chapter of the book. Approaches to violence. There are differences not only in defining violence but also in methodological approaches to studying it, depending on the discipline in question. Evolutionary psychologists, social biologists, anthropologists, archaeologists, and bioarchaeologists, psychologists and psychiatrists, criminologists, as well as historians, sociologists, and political scientists have all put forward theories about violence ranging from its origins in early hominins and animals to contemporary theories surrounding its causes, meanings, and aftermaths. Across many disciplines, the debates still revolve around the binary of whether humans are innately violent, that is, whether violence is part of our evolutionary and genetic makeup, or whether it is contingent upon cultural and historical context. For evolutionary psychologists, violence is rooted in the deep prehistoric past. It is a biological mechanism that has evolved over centuries. Our aggressive impulses flowed from the need to acquire food, other source resources, and mates, and to avoid predators, thereby assuring the continued survival of the species. Evolutionary thinking on violence posits a number of biological drives, or motives, that explain violence because of genes or hormones. Aggression, for example, becomes a means to achieve a particular goal such as food, shelter, or sex. Genes don't make us violent. They simply contain the propensity for violence. Evolutionary theory, according to Azar Gatt, cuts through the nature versus nurture debate on violence by postulating that aggression is a tactical skill, both innate and learned. That is, the environment plays a significant role in mediating gene expression. It explains why, according to this theory, some societies are more violent than others, depending on the environment in which humans were raised. Some evolutionary theorists go so far as to argue that specific physical traits were developed and selected over time to ensure the survival of the species. Thus, for example, the fist and the face, according to one study, supposedly evolved to both inflict injury and to minimize injury from punches during fights between males. Evolutionary psychology has been critiqued by the likes of biological psychologists Antonio Damasio and David J. Buller, who both point out that natural selection does not lead to homogeneous psychological traits. Buller argues that the human brain would have undergone significant change over the past 100,000 years, something that some evolutionary psychologists don't accept. However, the debates around biology or culture as prime drivers of violence appear increasingly redundant as scientists accept the role of culture and historians increasingly accept the role biology can play in shaping human behavior in the past. The other means by which scholars have attempted to draw links between the present and our earliest ancestors is to compare them with what are termed pure hunter-gatherer societies from the recent past, such as Aboriginal Australia or the Amazon. Among these people, it is argued there are very high rates of homicide, much higher, statistically speaking, than that of industrialized societies. Some anthropologists extrapolate from the study of these groups to suggest that pure hunter-gatherers must be like hunter-gatherers in prehistory, and that homicide rates among them must have also been as high. Using data about present-day hunter-gatherers to make inferences about our prehistoric past is, for some, a questionable approach,
but these studies feed into the ongoing debate in anthropological circles between those who argue that early humans were very violent and that pre-agricultural societies were always at war, and those who contest such blanket characterizations and argue that there was little violence among early hunter-gatherers. The first view was common among anthropologists and archaeologists until the 1996 publication by Lawrence Keeley, War Before Civilization, a seminal work which sparked a wave of new research and a debate that continues to this day. Keeley made a convincing case for the existence of conflict and intergroup warfare in prehistory, debunking so-called anthropological myths about peaceful hunter-gatherers by examining the archaeological evidence in a different way. Other anthropologists such as Douglas Fry and Brian Ferguson have questioned Keeley's assumptions and argue that hunter-gatherers were more inclined to avoid interpersonal as well as inter- and intra-group violence and that overall they lived peaceful lives. According to these scholars, violence and warfare, defined broadly as socially organized collective deadly aggression between two or more groups, only came after humans developed sedentary lives with the invention of agriculture some 12,000 years ago. The crux of this debate is around definitions of warfare and the question of culture, which, put simply, means that you had to have something to fight about, or for, and not just scarce resources. In this view, warfare is an invention of complex, stratified societies. There is now a growing consensus that intergroup violence, warfare, existed in nearly all prehistoric societies, but debates around its frequency, nature, role, and significance continue to take place. Then there is the archaeological record. There are two kinds of objects that archaeologists and bioarchaeologists examine when determining whether violence has occurred in the deep past: rock art that depicts intergroup violence and skeletal evidence that points to violent trauma, head injuries, bone fractures, or a weapon lodged in or found close enough to human bone to lead to the conclusion that it was the cause of death. It is, however, notoriously difficult to interpret rock art, and just as difficult to determine whether physical damage on a skeleton was caused by fighting, an accident, or some ritual that has been lost in time. Although several massacre sites have been found in parts of Europe and Africa for the Mesolithic and Neolithic periods, interestingly, nothing yet has been found for these periods in Southeast or East Asia. There are no cave paintings of group conflict or skeletal remains of traumatic violence from the Paleolithic, representing most of human existence. The current debates regarding hunter-gatherers mirror in some respects the old debates around the works of Thomas Hobbes and Jean-Jacques Rousseau. Hobbes believed that all interpersonal relations were violent and that violence was a natural and inevitable part of social life. Rousseau believed that natural man was in essence peaceful and was corrupted by civilization. Neither of these positions is tenable. Humans are not one or the other. Humans are capable of violent outbursts and brutal behavior, but we are also capable of cooperation and collaboration. Indeed, society can only exist when the vast majority of interpersonal relations are free of violence. Sociologists often look to history to help explain violent human behavior. The three most influential theorists on violence do this: Max Weber, Norbert Elias, and Michel Foucault. I will come back to them intermittently, but note that these theorists of violence, upon whom scholars rely heavily in formulating their own interpretations, are Western European. They have been so central to understanding violence in the modern world that it has resulted in a very Western-centric approach. it is time to rethink our understanding of violence in the non-Western world, but given the limited space, not here. The most I can do is to try and incorporate scholarship, when and where possible,
from other eras and cultures.
Weber Elias and Foucault each had very different approaches to understanding violence, even if they understood and linked violence to the history of punishment and the state. Weber believed that politics was about power, and that power was ultimately grounded in coercive violence. The state was a coercive institution that had managed to gain what he called a monopoly of violence over the centuries. Elias argued that over the course of time, and in parallel with the development of more complex judicial systems and policing, elite notions of masculine behavior evolved into a general disdain of interpersonal violence as no longer compatible with civilized behavior. It was only by internalizing instincts, and in particular aggression, that civilization could follow. Elias thus linked the rise of the state to the development of self-control, the mastery of impulsivity. Foucault argued that pre-modern states used the body as a stage on which to perform violence, such as spectacular public executions, to overcome any resistance to their centralizing impulses and to reinforce the state's legitimacy. Punishments had to be spectacular spectacles because there was no other way of enforcing the law. That violence, according to Foucault, eventually gave way to another kind of disciplinary power: prisons, barracks, schools, and factories. Violence in the Western tradition is thus posed as a problem that can be solved by applying rational thought. This kind of thinking can be found in the likes of Elias, or more recently in the work of Harvard psychologist Steven Pinker, who argue that violence is the exact opposite of civilization or of rationality. For historians and some historical sociologists, by contrast, violence is almost never senseless, and it is almost never irrational. It always has a purpose and a function, even if it is not immediately obvious to the outside observer. That doesn't mean to say that violence cannot be irrational, but that all acts of violence, even the seemingly irrational, such as road rage, the lone gunman with mental health issues, or football hooligans, can be explained. For many sociologists and criminologists, violence is about power, power to inflict injury, power to impose one's will on and to dominate another, and the power to resist. Violence can be deployed by the powerless against the powerful. For historians, the distinction between legitimate and illegitimate forms of violence can be so blurred as to become meaningless. This was the case, for example, when brown shirts carried out what was referred to as the people's justice by publicly humiliating and shaming Jews or women who had slept with Jews on the streets in 1930s Germany. There were Nazis in government who did not necessarily approve of the brown shirts' behavior, but it was tolerated since it was the kind of exclusionary violence that contributed towards the creation of a racial state. Another example was the American soldiers at Abu Ghraib, who abused and tortured with the knowledge and approval of their political and military superiors. Some of the techniques they practiced dated back to the Cold War. It would be difficult to call these examples of violence legitimate in any normative sense. In both examples, individuals may know they are committing an act of violence, but think that it is perfectly acceptable, that the circumstances require it even. The distinction between legitimate and illegitimate then says a good deal more about the nature of the law or state power than it does about the nature of violence, since it often neglects the obvious question: who decides what is legitimate and what is illegitimate? The problem is complicated even further when the notion of legitimate is broadened to embrace violence as a useful instrument to achieve just ends, by overthrowing a tyrannical polity, ousting a colonial oppressor, or dismantling exploitative structures and institutions. In those instances, violence can arguably become a moral imperative, and in the process become redemptive. Two very different approaches to historicizing violence appeared during the 1970s and 1980s. The first approach emerged out of cultural history, exemplified by people like Natalie Zeman Davis, who in 1973 published a groundbreaking study on the rights of violence in the 16th century France. Davis was able to throw light on the behaviours that historians until then had dismissed as seemingly irrational acts of barbarism or savagery by interpreting them in terms of their social symbolic significance. She created a paradigm for a great deal of the cultural analysis of violence that was to follow. The other approach emerged out of the social history of crime with people like James Sharp, one of, if not the first person, to use the term history of violence in the English language. Sharp, along with several other English historians of the 1980s, focused on the criminal courts in the early modern period, attempting to trace, statistically, the decline of violence by looking at homicide rates. This trend is best exemplified by the work of the Cambridge criminologist Manuel Eisner. These two approaches, one centred on understanding the meanings of violence and symbolism attached to it, the other based on quantitative methodology, have continued to the present day. There is, admittedly, not always a clear-cut distinction between the cultural and the criminological. They sometimes overlap, but they broadly represent the two dominant methodological currents in the history of violence, creating two very different trajectories with two very different objectives. Scholars who are preoccupied with rates of different kinds of violence, homicide in particular, but also deaths in war as well as rape figures, domestic abuse figures, and so on, tend to argue for an overall decline in violence. However, measuring some of these kinds of violence, as we shall see, can be problematic. There are not only issues of definition, what constitutes homicide and rape can vary enormously from one historical period and from one legal jurisdiction to another, but the trustworthiness of some of the data is debatable, while the statistics are always open to interpretation. Important as it is to get a sense of patterns, trends, and variations across time and place, most forms of intimate violence are hidden from view and remain grossly underreported to the authorities. Moreover, quantifying violence does not necessarily give an accurate portrayal of overall levels of violence in society at any given time. On the other hand, scholars who are preoccupied with cultural interpretations of violence look to understand its meanings and forms. It often becomes a tool of communication and representation, whether considered legitimate or not, and it is often tied to notions of masculinity.
Most of what I look at in this book places specific forms of violence within a larger cultural context.
The context is not a casual explanation for violence, but it helps us to understand the conditions in which it is perpetrated or practiced. The underlying assumption is that to understand violence, one must analyze the ideas, values, and cultural practices embedded in the act. So when learning about violence here, don't think of it as a single act or event, but as an outcome of a process that is always dependent on the personal, social, cultural, religious, and political context in which it takes place. How violent was the past? There is a common misperception that people in the ancient, medieval, and early modern worlds were brutal and violent, that they were desensitized to death, quick to anger, and all too ready
to resort to violence to resolve disputes. The further one goes back in time, the more violent it was supposed to have been. This is the kind of thinking one can find in recent works by political scientists John Mueller, Azar Gatt, and Joshua Goldstein, and the evolutionary psychologist Steven Pinker. They all postulate the decline in violence over the centuries by pointing to a diminution in conventional warfare and deaths in war, especially in the 20th century, and to the decline of homicide rates in Western European countries from peaks in the 13th century to the relatively low rates today. They tend to use homicide rates in Western Europe, where record-keeping was more or less accurate, and deaths in warfare, to draw conclusions about overall levels of violence in any given society. This is a view that is contested, so I'll come back to it later, but it is worth pointing out that almost none of the authors who hypothesize a decline in violence, with the exception of Peter Spierenberg, at the crossroads of history, criminology, and sociology, are historians. The disparity in understandings usually centers on historical interpretations of the past and the use of statistics to demonstrate the extent of the violence. Pinker and Eisner, for example, use statistics to posit a view of the pre-modern world as brutal and bloody, a world that was transformed from the mid-17th century onwards into one in which interpersonal violence became increasingly unacceptable, and state displays of violence, such as public executions, were no longer considered to serve an educated purpose, so that they eventually disappeared. A process of civilization, in part brought about by the Enlightenment, is meant to have transformed the ways in which people thought about and reacted to violence. It is no coincidence that this happened in the 18th century, at the same time as the concept of natural rights and ideas about human rights and human dignity were beginning to emerge. Those who contest the decline thesis argue that the past is often made out to be more violent than it was, especially in popular culture. The decline thesis only really works if world history is divided into two phases. Before the Enlightenment, the world was superstitious, cruel, and violent. After the Enlightenment, the world was rational and more peaceful. No one contests the idea that the pre-modern world was violent. Medieval law recommended public executions, burning, branding, blinding, drowning, and castration for felonies. This use of judicial torture and spectacular uses of public execution were common in Europe from the 15th to the 18th century. As a matter of historical fact, however, scholars cannot say with any certitude that people in the pre-modern world were more violent or less violent than we are today. The medieval historian Warren Brown, for example, has concluded that 13th century England as a whole was not significantly more violent than the US or EU around the turn of the 21st century. That precept that people in previous centuries were no more violent than we are today guides our thinking about violence and the past. Take prehistory as an example. There is limited material evidence in the archaeological record for physical violence in the deep past, but it does exist. There are a couple of notable sites, predating the archaeological revolution, which in the Middle East occurred some 12,000 years ago. A site in present-day Croatia known as Sandania II that dates back from 27,000 years ago contains the remains of 29 people with their skulls smashed. At Jebel Asabi, now in northern Sudan, a cemetery that dates from around 13,000 years ago consists of 61 individuals, some of whom had been killed by arrows. The archaeological evidence for violence is much more widespread after the agricultural revolution. Some of the largest sites found come from Central Europe, such as Aspen-Sletz in Austria, where the remains of over 200 individuals have been found,
most of the skulls had lethal fractures. Scholars conclude from this and similar archaeological evidence from prehistory that our own species, Homo sapiens, fought and killed each other during the Upper Paleolithic, 50,000 to 10,000 years ago, that violence occurred between groups, intergroup violence, and that violence occurred between individuals within groups, intra-group violence. Warfare and violence came to humans quite early on, before agricultural settlements, and before cities existed. People killed and massacred, even if the reasons they did so cannot be known with any certitude. It is, however, impossible to draw any overarching conclusions from the existing archaeological record about the extent of violence in the deep past. A recent study on prehistoric Japan, for example, concluded that violence, including warfare, was not common. There is a recognition that violence was an integral part of social life in previous centuries, depending on the epoch being discussed, but there is reason to believe that life was not as violent as has been made out in the media and in film. Forms of violence, as well as rates of violence, varied enormously over time and from one region of the world to another, but as we shall see, all past societies were differently violent. That is, violence was used differently in different situations, according to what was considered acceptable and what was not. The question then is not how violent was such and such a period, but rather how was such and such a period violent?